From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast, and it's time for the Friday Roundtable here at ClassicRock981.com, LondonNewsToday.ca, and wherever it is you get your podcasts. Of course, the Craig Needles Podcast is powered by our friends over at the Covent Garden Market and at downtown London. I am joined here in the studio today by political insider Sarah Browning, PhD candidate AJ Ray, and the executive director of Youth Opportunities Unlimited, Steve Cordes, is here. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Good day.
There's a lot going on, and I want to start by, and it feels like I'm saying this every week on the roundtable, I want to talk about a housing story, but this time it's Doug Ford.
I'm so surprised.
Yeah, I'm shocked too. This time, Doug Ford has been asked about, hey, what about as-of-right development for fourplexes? And he just says flat, no, I'm against it. I don't like it. Paul Calandra essentially doubled down when asked about it later in the day. This is just an absolute own goal by the provincial government, I think. I don't understand anything about this policy piece. It seems to run entirely counter to what Pierre Poilievre wants to say. And Sarah, what I said on Twitter yesterday was, when Pierre Poilievre wants to tell us there are housing gatekeepers in Canada, I think he's right about that. But what Pierre Poilievre probably doesn't want is Doug Ford to be one of the gatekeepers. And that's what's going on here.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, I think to walk it back a little bit, you know, we look at Bill 23, and it was the first piece of legislation to have as of right threeplexes. Mm-hmm. And when we look back to when that was introduced, everybody was up in arms over that piece of legislation. And so for me, you know, I think in an ideal world, we have as of right fourplexes, you know, in a city like London. They are allowed. It's just not as of right. I would love to see the numbers. I'm not entirely convinced that people are lined up out the door waiting to build fourplexes in London. I'd be curious to see what the uptake is even on threeplexes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think in my opinion, it's like, first, we weren't happy that he was introducing as of right threeplexes.
Yeah.
And then now it's like, okay, well, four isn't enough. Or
right.
Sorry, you know, three wasn't enough. So now we need four. And when's it going to be five?
Yeah. And I want to know who's unhappy about the three, because I was happy about three.
Yeah.
I would and there it is.
Yes.
And I would like to see four. And maybe he took some heat on three. And now here's what's going on with four, AJ.
Well, and just to quibble a little bit with Sarah's point on, people aren't lining up at the door on the threeplexes right now because they actually are still quite restricted. Yes, the province has said you can build them as of right, but municipalities are very sneaky in how they abuse the zoning system and the consent system. That's and the entire development application
and
process.
And here come the housing gatekeepers we were talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. And so really it's fourplex does need to happen because every other logical jurisdiction in the world has as of right fourplex, mm-hmm. and it works exceptionally well. But on the flip side, you also have to fix the planning system. That is what is broken right now. When Pierre talks about a broken system and housing gatekeepers, yes, we have provincial politicians that are acting like clowns, and I put Mr. Ford in that group now. But I also think we have a real problem with housing gatekeepers that are sitting in staff roles and sitting at municipal councils that cause the entire process to break down.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I certainly wouldn't say that Doug Ford is the only person that falls into the housing gatekeeper file. But I just think from a political messaging perspective, if you're Pierre Poilievre, he can't be one of the people.
No.
It's got to be like, okay, you're not happy with your municipal government. We're going to, you know, adjust this particular federal policy or that particular federal policy. And I think that Canadians are clearly, based on polling, responding to that messaging. But this kind of throws a wrench into the works. Steve, what do you think of fourplex housing and as of right development conversations that we've been having? Well, clearly we have a housing shortage and we've got to do something.
Exactly. And if it creates a more accessible option for buying or renting a home, what a great step forward on that side, on the intensification side. The other piece I think that really makes sense, the more and more we intensify, the more we can rely on integrate our public transit systems. We're not sprawling like we have been over and over. And it's kind of gobsmacking when you see the premier say, well, you know, nobody in this neighborhood wants 6 or 8 foot or 8 story buildings.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how a fourplex becomes an 8 story building.
Yeah, I'm still trying to work out that math.
Everybody gets a floor and a half, obviously. Yeah, just double stack on top of each other.
But the privilege that goes with that is just so out of step with the reality of where so many people are at right now, too.
Yeah, and I think that this might be one of the ones, and we've seen Doug Ford do this a few times, AJ.
The flagpole.
Where he says, oh, wait a minute, I've said something and not everybody's happy. People are mad, so I'm going to change my mind.
Yeah.
This might be one of those.
Well, and it's very clear based on insider news that there was dissension at the cabinet table. And I also found it quite interesting that neither Minister Calandra or Minister Flack chose to be present at that news conference in which Ford decided to go out on a limb here. Now, I do have to say Calandra later came out with a waffly statement about, you know, four stories and six stories and eight stories, but he never actually said the word fourplex, which I found really interesting, where Ford very much was like, no fourplexes in the middle of neighborhoods. Yeah. Which, again, I showed some photos from an old Canadian Urban Institute report from 2017 called Visualizing Density. If you actually look at what fourplexes look like already in the province, they look exactly like any other single detached home or townhouse. So it's really interesting that he's gone so far out. And again, I'm going to call him Flagpole Ford. He's going to run this up the flagpole. He's going to see that it's not blown right in the wind. And he's going to walk this back probably in 3 weeks.
May not even take that long. I would suspect, you know, Rob Flack has just taken on this job. And I don't know. I've talked to Rob a few times, obviously, professionally. I don't know Rob that well. Some of you do. I would suspect that Rob would have seen that this was the plan and been, I don't know if annoyed is the word I would use, but this is not what we need to do. He's a smart guy. He knows that.
I mean, the one thing I would say, too, is, as much as the province can set direction like this, I think, and I'm not going to put words in any MPP's mouth or any minister's mouth, but we collectively have seen how hard it is to get things done in the municipality.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, the province can do all they want. They could have, as of right, name your number of units. To AJ's point, most of these problems still end up at City Hall. I mean, we've talked about this.
And at a PPM where everyone's yelling about that they don't want, you know, too many cars in their neighborhood or they don't want too many kids in their neighborhood or whatever it is.
Yeah. And you know, we've all been involved in politics at different levels and in different ways and in housing in different ways. But it's like, you know, AJ, I can speak to you anyways. We've both been in campaigns together and done those types of things.
And we've heard the stories at the door.
Yeah, and you know, I've campaigned before where we were accused of being too pro-development, and that was, you know, less than 10 years ago. So we keep seeing these things. We're not really seeing the changes at City Hall that need to happen. So I think, you know, Doug Ford is doing what he can do. He's also working within the confines of federal policy when there's massive problems at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can only change so much when it comes to zoning and regulation, when we've got too many people coming into the country and we can't give them a home. We've got massive mortgage fraud problems. We've got money laundering problems. We've got all of these ways in which our housing system is being abused. And you can, like I said, you can change the zoning and, you know, allow fourplexes all you want. It's ultimately not going to address the bigger problem.
What I would say to that is, all these things need to be handled, you know, they're we've got to rethink how we do development. We've got to take a look at, like you said, foreign money coming into the housing system and how that's made an impact. We've got to look at, of course, the way that colleges in this province, mostly in this province, but other Canadian provinces as well, have really opened the floodgates for student visas and what that's done to housing in and around Fanshawe College, as an example, and elsewhere in London, sort of the spill-off effects of that. All these things are part of what we're doing here, right? Yeah. And just if we're going to bend to the knee to NIMBYs, as the premier did the other day, I just don't think we have a chance to solve the problem before the starter's pistol even fires off. Right.
I would love to see mayors across the province come out and say, you know what, Mr. Ford, we're going to have as of right fourplexes in our municipality, no matter what you say. I would love to see that kind of uprising. I don't think we're going to see it.
I would agree with that entirely.
And we're going to deliver consent applications and development applications within 90 days, as the legislation requires, not quibble about stop clocking and asking for more studies midway through the process because we know we're running out of the time, or issuing an outright rejection because we know it'll take you 3.5 years to get a hearing at the board. So,
if you're running flagpole items through the media, the premier could have run a very different flagpole item. Would be, hey, we're going to look at how we can intensify. Maybe fourplexes aren't enough. Maybe we need to push the government, the federal government, in a different direction. We need to free up more access to intensify our brown spaces and so on in every city in this province. But he didn't do that. He flagpoled in an entirely opposite direction. I think that's a bit of a gut punch for anybody looking to create more housing for people.
Again, it's such an unforced error again. of like, there's so many different ways he could have rephrased that and still got to the same conclusion or the same outcome of, you know, it really, the problem sits with the municipalities.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I would have loved to have heard him say exactly what Sarah just said. Exactly. All right, mayors, let's go. I need you guys to be on board with this, mayors and councils. Because really, when it comes to the final say in a lot of this stuff, or it does come down to the local neighborhood level. So it's your councilors and your mayors who are making these calls. And they're the ones that have got to kind of get going here and be rowing in the right direction. And Ford has said this before to his credit, but that's just how he should have responded earlier this week when he was talking about fourplexes, I think. Last thing on housing before we go here. This, I would suspect, is going to be the key issue federally when we go to the polls, whenever it is. I think it's going to be the issue. I think affordability kind of spins off from housing, but really it's all wrapped up together. Do we think that this is something that turns into an issue on the campaign from the perspective of, will Pierre Poilievre say, oh yeah, there's housing gatekeepers? And might we hear Justin Trudeau saying, I don't know, talk to Doug Ford about this? Like, is that something that may happen here? I don't think that there's much that can occur that would prevent Pierre Poilievre from being prime minister whenever it is we do this next. But is that potentially a campaign storyline to watch whenever we do this, even though it is 18 months away, probably?
Well, I think what Pierre's got to avoid getting stuck with is the fact that the vast majority of premiers in the country right now are conservative leaning. And, you know, the Liberals have a pretty nasty talent during elections of being able to make us wear stuff that we're not actually responsible for at the end of the day. And we saw it in the 2021 campaign and the 2019 campaign. But really what I think will be key is the federal government has had their foot on the gas pedal with non-permanent residents since 2015. Mm-hmm. It is shocking, the numbers of people that have been welcomed to the country. And, you know, we are a growing country and we need to be welcoming immigrants, but there was no clear plan around.
And that's the issue I've got. I've got no problem with having immigration in Canada. We need immigration in Canada.
And
but
the
plan
thing,
was garbage, and the results are obvious.
And the other thing, too, is the feds have failed to enforce really any standard in regards to mortgage fraud. Sarah mentioned that. There's a lot of finance people that, if you go look at what they're saying right now, it's pretty scary what's going on over in the big banks with mortgage fraud. Like, we're talking, you know, the big five retail banks having tens of thousands of mortgages being discovered to be based on fraudulent income or fraudulent asset declarations. And so there's a real problem of, like, the entire system is overburdened with capital, and capital was too easy to access. Mm-hmm. That's the other problem. Interest rates were at the lowest they had ever been in the country's history for the longest time period in the country's history, and it shows.
The rich got richer.
The rich definitely got
richer. For a very long time, and we're seeing the consequences of that, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to things that Pierre Poilievre is going to be criticized for, I don't think it's going to be that Doug Ford didn't have fourplexes.
No, the Liberals are good, but the Liberals have to find something to get him on with housing, because he's going to dunk on them with housing. You know what I mean?
I will wear this hat for a second. I'm the president of the London West Conservatives here in town at the federal level. And this is what, like, I mean, the literacy when it comes to housing, finances, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, you're seeing people who are 25 years old and they're now talking about interest rates. 30, you know, people who are 30 years old, they understand all of the dynamics that have made housing more expensive, less affordable, and all those types of things. So, you know, I don't think that people are going to be played for fools in this election, and any government who tries to do that is really going to disenfranchise them. And, you know, we saw in 2015 and even in subsequent elections, it was the young people who kind of moved things for Trudeau, and they are very much not with him at all right now. And I think if they try to take cheap shots on the housing front, I just don't think it's going to work out for them.
Because, well, at the end of the day, and I know people are going to hear this and say jurisdiction. A lot of people don't care about jurisdiction.
No.
I've done everything right. I've gone to school. I've gotten a good job. I still can't afford a house. People are going to be pissed off about that.
Well, and they also just removed the first-time homebuyers tax incentive, which, to be honest, I think was a great move. It should have been done years ago. It never should have been introduced in the first place.
Disagree. It should not have been done before I got to buy my house.
Exactly. But that's the thing. There's going to be a lot of young people who are banking on that first-time homebuyer's incentive that have now lost it, and we're going to be heading into an election, and that's going to be the top thing in their mind is Justin Trudeau took away $10,000 from me. And so that's going to be a real problem that the Liberals are going to have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, it's I think that and affordability be sort of wrapped up into the key issue. We'll see. But obviously, 18 months is a long time for things to change. But you're going to change things fast.
Isn't it a to me, it's surprising when you look at the polls and you look at the percentage of people on lower income levels who are supporting the conservatives, and the conservatives have not come back with anything substantive around how we're going to change affordable housing levels. Doug Ford is a good example of that.
They don't need
We're going to build more of these, and he's staying in front of $1.5 to $2 million homes.
They don't need to.
No.
Yeah. Why?
No.
Why like I know these people are already voting for us. Why do we need policy for
exactly?
Them?
Yeah. I don't understand it, but that's what's happening.
And I agree. I think that if I were one of those voters, I would want to say, okay, we've got an affordable housing problem here. The Cretchen Martin liberals axed federal public housing. Maybe we could do something around that. But that's just not how the conversation has gone. But I think that people are just generally tired of this federal government and looking for something new. And the details in a lot of cases aren't super relevant to them.
Canadians aren't really good at telling governments who they like. They're really, really good at telling governments who they hate.
Yeah. We don't care for you anymore.
Yeah.
You don't work here.
And I think this is definitely going to be an angry election.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Let's get a little more local. I want to talk about the Thames Valley District School Board right now, because they are looking at doing a rebrand of their logo. They're looking at doing things I think they wanted the school board to be more competitive, I think, was one of the terms that they used.
Innovative?
Innovative was one of the terms
and
they
inclusive.
Used. And inclusive.
Yeah.
I played the
I don't
Simpsons.
Know why they're not inclusive already, because it seems that that is what they've been focusing on over the last decade, but okay.
I played the Simpsons.
Call your own issues.
Aren't these just buzzwords that dumb people use to sound important? and that's, you know, that's what they're doing, and that's all well and good. But they're also $18.5 million in the hole, and I know that we're hearing that the rebrand's not going to cost a lot of money. I don't understand what universe of rebrand doesn't cost a lot of money. Like you've got to replace logos that are on walls. You've got replacing the letterhead, like that's and we're doing stuff on the internet. That doesn't cost a lot of money. But we're talking about replacing logos on walls. We're
school
talking
signs.
About like that adds up. You've got a lot of schools. So what does it say about the board's priorities right now, Steve? If we're $18.5 million in the hole and we're also talking about this, are you concerned about it? Because as a parent of a Thames Valley District School Board or two Thames Valley District School Board students, I have some worries here.
Well, I guess it's a bold move, isn't it?
Yeah.
So on that front, yes, absolutely. I kind of concerned on a couple levels. One is, you're right, for fiscally, why is this the time to be doing something like that? Because there's also the communications team that now has to address issues related to the branding, even if you're going to fit it in over a period of time. It takes up a lot of staff resources that also equate to money. But also, too, I guess as a taxpayer, I step back and I get concerned when I think school boards have to compete with each other over students. And I know that's a bit naive because we have a multiple school board jurisdiction in this province, but it speaks to one of the problems when we have that, doesn't it? I remember way back, I guess I'm old enough to remember when I used to deal with in my job, the London Board of Education, the Middlesex County Board of Education, and then their counterparts in the Catholic system and so on. Mm-hmm. Things have certainly streamlined a lot since we have the London and District Catholic School Board and the Thames Valley District School Board. And I just wonder if there's opportunity to kind of streamline a little bit more.
What a concept.
Yeah, it's at least worth exploring.
Maybe not full amalgamation. It's worth exploring. How do we streamline more effectively?
I would be a fan of full amalgamation. I know that that's kind of a political third rail, but I would be a fan. I just think that this is a troubling window into the thought process behind what goes on at the school board. And I know that, and my friend Cheryl Miller would sit here and say, well, they don't get to do anything else. Of course, they're going to want to rebrand. They don't get to make any other decisions. And she's right. And maybe that's part of it. But that's what I look at here. And just sort of say, is this what we're talking about? Because it feels like you have other issues that are a problem here, Sarah.
Yeah. I mean, in my opinion, and I am now a young mother. So I'm paying attention to what's going on with schools and school boards and all that kind of thing a lot more. I've also noticed the moment you become a mom, the internet just shows you what all the other moms are talking about. And schools is one of them. Like, I mean, it's alarming to see how concerned parents are with what's going on in schools right now and how little it's being talked about at any level of government, really. TVDSB has a very serious reputation problem right now, and it has nothing to do with their logo. I tweeted about it the other day, but one of the biggest things is the skyrocketing levels of violence in schools. You have teachers who are being attacked at unprecedented levels. You have students who are being subjected to violence from other students. And again, you know, we can talk about the drivers behind this. I don't think, you know, sending kids home from school for a year was a great idea. I think we're still dealing with a lot of the consequences of something like that. But we've got a lot of violence. This same school board decided to pull police officers and school resource officers out of schools. I think that there are major consequences for that. And you've got, you know, overpopulated schools. That's another thing we're not talking about. You've got students, their parents are moving to, let's say, a West End neighborhood. They move there. They go to sign their kids up for school. Then they find out that their child is now going to be bused across the city to another school on the other end of the city. And we're not even talking about this. So it's like, you know, and you watch the school board meetings. These are not issues that are being discussed at the school board meetings at all. And so we're now focusing our efforts on something like this rebrand. And I really hope, you know, to be honest, we've seen this in the States. I hope that we start to see it more in Canada. These elections matter, too. I know that at the municipal level, you know, when election time comes around, the mayor is a big focus. Council is a focus to a large extent. But we don't talk about our TVDSB counselors. And I think that it's important that, and I think that we'll start to see it, parents are going to be more involved. There's a lot more at stake right now. And I don't think it's a given that our school boards are delivering what they maybe perhaps once delivered to families.
Yeah. I think really the big thing to take away from this is it's cowardice and it's diversion that's going on at the trustee level and at senior leadership within the board. They're using the rebrand as a distraction, but also as a signal to say, oh, hey, look, we're trying to fix our reputation problem. Here's our flashy new logo. Right. Here's our three-sentence statement about how we're going to change. But really, if you want to be competitive, deliver a better set of education to students at the end of the day. That's what's going to drive parents. Parents don't care about what the logo looks like. Parents don't care what your vision and mission statement are. They want to know, is their child getting an education? Is their child safe at school?
That's the big
one. Is their child going to learn something at the end of the day, whether that be from a teacher or their peers? And unfortunately, our entire school system in this city, in this region, has completely been, I'll say it, fucked up by decades of bad decisions that have now resulted in massive overcrowding, which we know from the literature leads to mass behavioral issues because students don't want to be sitting in asbestos-filled portables for hours and hours on end every day. And don't tell me there isn't asbestos in the tiles there, because a lot of portables still in service still have asbestos sitting in the tiles. It's just undisturbed. And so there's a lot of really big issues with infrastructure that are causing a lot of the behavioral issues. Well, I'll also say, I was speaking with a couple teachers last week, and they made a really interesting point of, on the inclusion side, we've done a really good job of now completely de-streaming everything, completely bringing in people that used to go to alternative education sites into main schools. But the problem is, we haven't brought along any of the resources that used to sit in those alternative school sites that would help students that had behavioral challenges or help students that had learning challenges. And now it's falling all on the teacher in the classroom to try and manage 30 students, in which 10 to 15 of them likely have a behavioral or mental health or learning challenge that typically would have been dealt with by someone else within the board or in a specialized curriculum site. And so there's a real challenge of, like, the pendulum almost has swung way too far away, and we need to come back and try and find a happy medium within how we're delivering education to students to ensure everyone succeeds. Because it's not fair to those students either. They're not getting an education. They're getting kicked out and sent home from school on a regular basis. They're entering the criminal justice system sometimes, which we want to talk about school resource officers. I mean, that's a real challenge if you're throwing resource officers into a system in which there's no actual pathway for diversion. I think, you know, it's unfortunately a cacophony of errors that now has culminated in, frankly, I think TVDSB should be put under provincial administration at this point.
Well, you know, I think it's such a great point about people who, students who may require additional supports and have traditionally required additional supports. Inclusivity has just become one of those buzzwords, right? I mean, we saw it with the SRO program. Having police officers in schools, they did a large study of this. The BIPOC population overwhelmingly was supportive of keeping police officers in schools. While in the name of inclusion, they were pulled by trustees and they're no longer in schools. People feel less safe. Now you've got something like this where you're talking about students who require more resources, different supports, and those types of things. And sometimes I think that we confuse what inclusion actually looks like. It doesn't mean the same thing for every single person. It's making sure that those students have the same opportunity to thrive, and that might look like different opportunities within the school system. The one other point that I'll make too is we look at test outcomes, standardized testing outcomes. London is falling behind seriously at both board levels, but the TVDSB actually significantly more so than the Catholic board. And so it's like, where's the accountability for that? How much is that coming up at these board meetings? Why are we talking about a rebrand? The best thing you can do for a rebrand is deliver a better education for students.
Right.
I mean, we talk about being competitive.
It would be
there's no competition to be had. Parents need to send their kids to school and they don't feel like they've got somewhere to send them right now.
I think that they believe there is competition to be had against another school board that I'm paying for, which is the London District Catholic School Board. And I think,
which is shockingly better run.
Well, yes. I would not dispute that for a second. The only reason I'd pick
and
the
I
public
wonder
one
what
is
the difference
is
might
Catholic
be,
one.
And I don't think it's the religion.
No, I don't think it is either. I think there's some staffing things that can be addressed there. But I just look at it and think what we're worried about is that we're bleeding, in some cases, students to the Catholic board, and they want to get those dollars back from the province because there's just a per student funding formula that goes along with that. And I think that that might be concern number one at the board office right now. And I don't think it should be. I think we've got other bigger fish to fry, as we've discussed here.
The reputation is earned at the school level for the most part. I think Sarah mentioned that earlier. And I happen to have been dealing with representatives in Thames Valley for years and years and years. And I can attest to amazing work that goes on in so many amazing schools. I know that one of the higher need schools in the whole school board, their staff rallies around every student in that school getting a gift at Christmas time before the holiday break. And it's not based on means, it's not based on whatever, and the teachers and the staff take this on their own accord to provide an inclusive and a wonderful environment for students and families that are struggling in many ways right now. That's an amazing part of a reputation. But we don't talk about those kinds of things. We talk about the behavioral issues and so on, and they're important. But I think what we have to do is look at, if they're looking at where they're spending their money, there's social issues everywhere these days, including in the school boards. So how's that money instead? How is it better spent supporting the students that are struggling, the families that are struggling? And there are better ways to spend the money, I think. I think that's what it comes down to. So I'm not knocking the board as a whole. I'm just saying on this particular issue, they could be spending the money at the school level and then building the reputation based on where there are problems, addressing those problems more effectively.
And I mean, we both know principals within the system on both the Catholic and the public side. And what I hear from the public principals is that they aren't getting support from the board.
Right.
It's a vacuum that they, a black hole that they try and address concerns or raise issues with, and it just gets ignored. And then they're told, you know, here's your 10% cut for next year in your budget, figure it out. Whereas in the Catholic board, it very much is that they are listening to their principals. They are bringing them into the conversation. They are bringing them along with the board. And so really, at the end of the day, to me, the competitiveness or, you know, what's going on is not that, you know, we have a Catholic board with religion and that's why people are choosing it. We have a Catholic board that's incredibly well run and religion is not at all a factor in this. Mm-hmm. And really the public board needs to start looking inside and figuring out how can we best emulate what the Catholic board's doing with how it's running itself. Because at the end of the day right now, the senior board office is not working and it's showing in the schools where people are just fighting a losing battle. And I think, you know, they're doing great work, but they need resources to do that work.
Right. But there are so many. It'd be interesting to really understand the profile of the students, too, because with a larger school board like Thames Valley, there's a lot deeper resources than in a Catholic school board. So the London District Catholic School Board. So they're probably attracting, or they may be attracting, a very diverse clientele, which would then speak to a school standardized test being lower compared to another one because the profile of the student base actually could be quite different.
But I mean, a lot of provincial statistics show that actually new immigrants tend to choose the Catholic board because of that religious preference. Because there are many Muslim students that choose to go to a Catholic school because of that faith-based approach to education. And so I would say actually the public board is probably, if you look at the statistics again, probably more made up of people that have been in Canada for a longer time than new Canadians and more diverse populations. So, but it would be an interesting thing to look at, Steve. Yeah, I agree.
I'd want to see it too. And I know that people from the board are going to listen to this and they're going to get mad at me because that's not the first time it's happened on this podcast.
Well, do your job and maybe we won't be getting mad. Honestly, come out in public and tell me how you're doing your job if you want us to stop criticizing you. Because right now you act like a black hole. You shut everyone out of discussions and decision making. Right now I'm dealing with an issue in Old East because, again, we have an issue with schools in Old East. And right now the board is completely stonewalling any public participation in that process. So you know what? You want to stop being criticized? Come out in public. Come on Craig's show. Mm-hmm. Make a statement. Open up your board meetings.
So, and what I will say is exactly what I said to them is you are an elected official. If you feel you can't or shouldn't talk about something publicly and you're taking unfair heat because of that, it's your electoral future that's on the line here.
Right.
You either talk about it or figure something out. Like, voters don't want to hear, I can't talk about that.
And if you think the issue is with the staff and the executive director, we'll get a control of your executive director.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. Yeah. He reports to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk LTC before we wrap up here. And the deputy mayor and the budget chair, Elizabeth Peloza, the budget chair and the deputy mayor, Sean Lewis, have said, you know what? It's time to take a look at the books over at London Transit. I don't think it's going to be cheap to do that. I think that that's going to cost some money, but maybe it's going to be worth it. Is it time to take a look at the books? And are you prepared? And Sean Lewis posted this on social media the other day. Are you prepared to look at the idea of bringing London Transit in-house? And there would be some cost that would come with that. There might be some savings. I'd need to be convinced whether the savings justify the cost, but are we prepared to have that conversation, do we think?
I feel like I've got a lot to say on this and I wouldn't normally. First of all, we've seen that the LTC is very supportive themselves of doing an audit. They actually moved to have this audit done internally before it was even brought to council. So I think that's great. They have shown every willingness to be open and transparent in this. One thing that I would say is if council is going to authorize an audit, I'd love to see the findings of this be public. That didn't happen the last time we did this. And if you look back at elections and public sentiment towards transit and all those types of things, there was a lot of criticism, a lot of questions, because quite frankly, there just wasn't accountability and transparency around what the future of transit will look like. And I think that that's ultimately cost LTC a lot of opportunities for growth, expansion, being able to service things. Again, I've said this about some other issues. It's so funny to me to watch the double standards take place. We're seeing all of this accountability around what's happening at LTC, and justifiably so. I think it's really important. I think more transparency is critical. We're seeing the same thing happen with the London Police Service. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. But for some reason, there's a double standard when it comes to something like some of our major social service agencies. We're not seeing the same level of accountability. So it's when tax dollars are being used to fund these programs, we need to make sure that the public has the ability to see what's going on, what's working and what's not working.
Because they deserve to.
Absolutely. And they're when something doesn't work, and the LTC, like I think, I've been critical of certain plans, things like BRT. I'm very, very supportive of funding our transit commission. They do great work, and ultimately we get what we pay for in this city. They are the lowest funded transit commission. Mm-hmm. Amongst comparable municipalities in the province. And so, we're complaining that they're asking for more funds. Well, first of all, they just drew down from their reserve fund, which is exactly what you want to see an organization like them do on a rainy day. That's why reserve funds exist. I don't think the municipality, City Hall, is as willing to draw on reserve funds as perhaps they should be. You know, we just came out of a pandemic. Ridership bottomed out. We had, very little
People weren't even paying for bus rides for a little while.
Exactly. Right? And so, LTC had to respond accordingly, still keeping buses on the street, and they had to draw from their reserves to do it. That's what we want to see. The last thing I'll say, we always talk about how good people don't come forward to volunteer for positions like this. There are some highly, highly competent people on LTC right now who I think are doing a very commendable job, and they're ensuring that the reputation of LTC stays intact. So to kind of see, I want to see this audit take place, but I think some of the pretenses under which it's being called for are disingenuous, and I don't think it's doing anything to be supportive of the ultimate mission of the LTC.
Stephanie Marentette, by the way, is going to be on this podcast on Wednesday after council makes their decision on the audit. She's going to be on, and she and I are going to talk about what they might find, or if they're even going to do the audit and the entire set of circumstances from there. But there will be an LTC voice on this podcast coming up next week. I am interested to hear a variety of things from that. The main one is when we were on this podcast talking about when the council decided, okay, we're going to fully fund the police, but we're going to not quite do this for LTC. We're going to not quite do this for the library. Some of the pushback from counselors, and Sean was on this podcast and said, look, we've written LTC the biggest check we've ever written them, and they can't find new routes from that. I've got some questions. And hey, we're here to answer the questions. Let's go. Do you think that we're going to find much, AJ? Maybe it's hard for us to say, but do you think that there's a lot of savings to be found within this organization?
No. LTC is probably the most shoestring, slapstick transit commission when it comes to funding, and they do an exceptional job. And what I think the audit's actually going to find is that the issues LTC is having is related to operational reliability. And it's because if you look out that door right now, probably those buses have been stuck in traffic down at Richmond and York for the last 15 minutes and are finally catching up on their route. They're over a half hour behind on headways now. And so reliability is one of the biggest things that I think this audit is likely going to find, because we've got a real infrastructure problem in this city. We've stopped investing in infrastructure. We've stopped investing in smart infrastructure. We've built half a pretend BRT through half the city. And I think really another big mistake that we could make is bringing LTC in-house, because it's not going to solve the problem. And there is no municipality in Canada of London size that operates transit directly. That would be the biggest mistake that we could make, because the issues we're having right now with transportation is because of engineering at the city. They've decided they had a vision for this city, and they also cut corners in a lot of cases. And they're responsible for a lot of the issues we're seeing now that affects LTC operational reliability. So to me, the audit's a distraction, but I also think it would be welcomed by LTC, especially if it goes public, because it's going to show that they're doing their job at the end of the day, and the issue is actually with the city. Right. Now, I also
I'm on LTC, I'm willing to, like, and if you think that things are going okay out there, I'm willing to bet big on, here, everyone sees this.
And my understanding is that's exactly what they want. Yeah. Like, you know what, let's go. Come in here, take a look at our books, and let's hold a press conference with the results. We expect City Hall to publish these.
And I think the other issue I have, which I brought up during the police board issues that we were talking about a couple weeks ago during the budget, I have a real issue right now with councillors critiquing commissions in which council sends councillors to sit on said commissions. Mm-hmm. Don't be critiquing the commission directly or going around your council colleagues. If you have an issue, haul your colleague before committee.
Yeah, you say Jerry Pribble, David Ferreira, what the hell's going on?
Haul Jerry and David before committee, and you ask the questions. And if Jerry and David can't provide you solid answers, we'll replace Darian and Javid on the commission if you have the votes on council.
Can I just say something? Is there a lack of, like, how many councillors can you really say, okay, of the 14 that are there now, we're going to send you to this committee and we think that you're going to add to it and be able to bring back good reports to council and really make a positive impact?
I would hate to impugn the character of some counselors on that.
It's not even a character thing.
Yes,
it's just
Craig,
it's not 14, right? Yeah. It may not be 7.
Yeah.
Like, it may not even be a majority of people.
Yeah, exactly. It may not even be 7.
And
so,
you know what? Elected representation on commission boards is important. But I think, again, one of the issues that Sarah and I have seen at the door in a lot of cases is voters often don't evaluate candidates based on their expertise or ability to contribute to a city commission. Yeah. Even though when we talk about municipal governance, they are the worst kind of corporation, because they have no profit incentive, but they have no revenue tool. And so it's nothing but cost centers. And then on top of that, they're governed by people that have no expertise or no qualifications to be sitting on a corporate board at any point in their lifetime. And so I think really it's a challenge of, we need to be electing better councillors. And I'm not going to name names, but, you know, I agree with Craig that the 14 around the horseshoe, there's a lot missing.
Well, Steve, I wonder how does the public feel about the service they get from London Transit right now?
It's terrible. And I'm not blaming the commission and saying it's terrible. That's maybe on a lot of levels, including the amount of money that they get from the city. You can't have the lowest funded transit system and expect great service. That's not going to work. So if the scope of an audit came back and said, here's, you know, you've got the London plan, you've got an intensification plan, you've just released some goals around, you know, alternative to vehicle commutes and so on in your 10-year, 20-year cycle and so on, and you want to increase ridership, well, then the question becomes, hopefully, in terms of part of this scope, how do we get there? Because a wish isn't going to get us there, and a hope isn't going to get us there. And
definitely not a prayer.
Not a prayer either. So how are we going to get there? And if it includes all of that stuff, wouldn't that be great? But I know that we support a lot of young people at YOU that will never in any foreseeable future own a car, nor do they even want to have a car. It's not just a matter of income. They don't want it. But on the other hand, if you're in London relying on transit to go from corner to corner of the city, you're not going to get there very easily. We've got people that have 3-hour daily commutes for a part-time job.
In a city that you can drive across in 25 minutes.
Well, I think that's, you know, we've heard so many counselors over the years talk about we need to incentivize people to get on transit. Okay, the fact that a car has doubled in price over the last 3 years
that should have done everything
is incentive
you need.
Enough. Yep. We are a one-car family. We hope to continue to be a one-car family.
Yeah. That's where we're at, too.
In the south end of the city. Yeah. I live nowhere close to the core. I remember when we moved to our house, I looked at taking a bus. I work up by the university. Like, of all the places in the city, the university should be one of the easiest to get to. It was like 3 different buses over an hour commute to get there, and I don't have time to do that. So it's like, you know, there's so many people that stand to benefit from a better system right now. They will pay for it. We will, you know, I would get a bus pass and take the bus if I knew that I could get somewhere. The fact that I can't get to a mall, one of the city's top employers, or really any of the city's top employers in a reasonable time, is terrible. Like, I mean, we can't rely on transit.
And again, it's that concept of the death spiral that I was talking about when I was on with Scott a couple weeks ago, of if the service is so bad, nobody like Sarah wants to buy a pass, which means anyone who can't own a car has to accept poor service, and then the cycle just keeps repeating itself until we end up in this hole where we have an LTC system that can't even get a bus to show up on time every 30 minutes.
I worry about when BRT opens up. Like,
it's going to be a disaster, in my opinion. I think that project is going to go down as one of the greatest infrastructure failures in southwestern Ontario, because engineering cut an unbelievable number of corners. It's not going to speed up travel times. It's probably actually going to reduce or lengthen travel times. And it's going to occupy so many resources of like physical buses and drivers within the system just to deliver a service that frankly only serves maybe 20% of the modal demand in the city, because it completely misses Western and 2 of the hospitals.
Yeah. Now, part of that was... I think that the part of that was the train tracks that are outside this window. Part of that was the fight with Western about, oh, you want the BRT to go on our roads?
Oh, everyone's to blame in this city for this silliness. Everyone's to blame. But it is going to go down as a failure in my mind.
I would agree with that. A couple things. AJ, you mentioned, you know, buses being stuck at York and Richmond. Whoever's doing construction there needs to hurry up.
Oh, my God.
secondly.
Talk about where we need performance measures.
Yes.
The cranes are in the sky right now. Or the cranes in the sky at Jones Place right now, Steve. And I'm very excited about that, to be clear.
I have no issue with Jones Place construction.
Thank you.
Also, I just think that the paratransit part of this has to be discussed when we get into why we're doing the audit, because to me that was where the performance was very weak. And I understand that it's not fun to be in the media fighting with Dr. Preston. I understand that. However, like,
it's because he's right all the time.
Well,
that's
he's
the problem.
He's a sharp dude. However, that was one where I think for the most part, To get a really granular level here, I've got I've had situations with LTC where I've fought with them and lawyers have gotten involved. I won, but so I understand that I'm not the first person they want to call when stuff is going on. I get that, but every media outlet in the city, it was kind of like pulling teeth to try to figure out what's going on with paratransit here. So Jeff goes on all the media outlets in the city and says, well, what's going on here, guys? And they're kind of getting beat up a little bit, and they're wind up looking pretty bad. I think that was poorly handled by them. And I think that at least partially opened the door here for council to say, what's going on over there? Because this isn't a good look when paratransit riders are in this situation and they can't book online. And I know that's changing, and LTC has made some changes to paratransit. paratrans, and that's fine. I think that the paratransit mess here has kind of opened the door for some people in this community to say, what's going on over there at LTC? And maybe if that was handled better, maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation.
But I mean, paratransit is also a signal of the broader fact that the organization itself doesn't have the funds to deliver regular bus service, let alone a good enough paratransit service.
But then come on the podcast or come on the radio and tell me that.
But Craig, you know this. Every government right now, whether it be federal, provincial, municipal, school board, commission, has this aversion to public accountability and public communication. Like, it is a real problem within our public services that public servants think that they just go into their office, they do their work, and they're not accountable at all, and they should not communicate anything out to the public. And then even elected members get really uptight when you ask them to answer a couple questions or actually take delegations at a public meeting.
But to me, that's actually the bigger problem here is we see such little accountability from elected officials. If you're city staff, you work at the direction of city council. And I feel like everyone has forgotten that in this. Like, if you're gonna sit on council and you're gonna be responsible for overseeing certain boards and commissions, you are ultimately accountable for the performance of those. If you disagree with what they're doing and you lost the votes, then that's fine. But come on and talk about that. Like, I mean, and it shouldn't, you know, when we start seeing elected officials attacking commissions or boards or members or those types of things, like, you're the one in charge here. Like, you're the one who's sitting at city council.
You're the one that can fix this problem.
Right. And so you should be answering for some of these problems. And if you don't want to fund it, then tell us why you don't want to fund it and tell us what the alternative is. I think we need to be asking more of our elected officials.
I mean, Dr. Preston has made it very clear. The solution for paratransit is more funding and some logic applied to how the system works, which it seems like, based on what Scott said and what's come out recently, that they're trying to fix the operations of the system, trying to improve that. But it doesn't solve the fact that there just is a sheer lack of vehicles and drivers on the road to be able to meet demand for paratransit. That's a funding issue. That can be solved by Deputy Mayor Lewis by bringing forward a motion to actually properly fund paratransit.
So let me ask you this question then, AJ, and I'll ask all of you this question. If council had said, okay, well, the tax hike's 8%, and then the very last minute said, you know what, it's now 10, but we're going to give all the new money to LTC, how would Londoners have reacted to that, do you think?
I mean, they'd probably be up in arms, but they were already up in arms over 8.5%. Yeah, so, I mean, what's another 1.5%? But as Sarah mentioned earlier, the city's sitting on a massive reserve fund. It's also sitting on a massive development charges reserve fund. Yep. And they absolutely refuse to actually deploy that money in any meaningful way. And you know what? We've made decades of bad decisions. We're in a really tough spot. And the only way out of it, I think, is going to be spending some of those reserves.
This is the result of decades of bad decisions. Yeah. Underfunding transit, underfunding the library, underfunding police. And now here we are.
And 0% tax increases under Fontana.
Look, and Councillor Stevenson actually asked this question. She said, okay, if we're going to open the door to funding social service agencies from the reserve funds, then why aren't we opening the door to other things? Like, I mean, this
paratransit
is why
we part of the social safety net.
Like, this is why we have those funds. And so for me, one of my problems is the same people complaining about the supposed 49%, which I think is actually a 46% increase to LTC, the request there. We don't want to open the door to reserve funds. And it's like, for me, I'm more upset that I'm paying for a terrible service that people can't rely on. I don't want it to be some mushy, crappy middle. Like, let's fund a proper transit service, because I think as a city, we're going to benefit tremendously from doing that. And I don't think I'm fine with the 8% tax increase. It sucks. And we're going to be paying a lot of money for it. And I will be myself. But I mean, at the end of the day, we need these services. People don't feel safe in their homes. People can't get to their jobs if they even have a job at this point. And so the fact that we're not drawing on our reserves for any of these programs is problematic.
And we've already decided the budget. I think that there was at least some conversation to be had about surrounding, do you guys really need this training center right now? Do you guys really, like, you know what I mean? Like, and obviously that gets into the whole situation with Ontario Police College and do we want to have that fight? And Toronto didn't want to have that fight. I understand that. But I just think that if they had said, okay, do you guys really need that training center right now? And instead we're going to spend half what we would have spent on the training center on buses and take the other half and we're just going to not tax that. And then we're going to do the training center in a few years. Maybe people are feeling differently about it, but that's not the way it went. So now everyone has to own what's going on. So I have to own that the bus system's not very good and this police stuff better work out.
But the problem there, Craig, is there was no discussion of, hey, let's use the DC reserves to pay for the London Police Training Center.
Instead, let's pit different agencies and boards and commissions against. Let's play a zero-sum
shell game. I called it budget hunger games. I think you were here when I called it that.
It is budget hunger games. And what is really frustrating is there are so many things they are funding out of the general tax base that could have been funded out of the DC reserve that is for infrastructure associated with growth. It is very easy to prove that the city has grown massively. There are many new officers. And so building a new training center for said officers should come out of development charges. That is exactly what a development charge is for. But yet we refuse to spend any of that money. And the other thing, too, is we're having no discussion of how to strategically deploy reserves so that we're not using reserves for operations. Yes, LTC used their reserves. But to be honest, when you're talking about public accounting 101, they kind of made a bit of a mistake in drawing so much on reserves to pay for operating costs. You should never use reserves for operations. But they were in a crisis scenario, and you know what? They showed tremendous leadership that a lot of commissions and the city itself didn't show during the pandemic. When it comes to now the city's decision making, it's got to come out of the reserves and it's got to be dedicated towards capital so that we can free up portions of the general tax base to then fund paratransit as an ongoing service that is predictable and isn't going to get slashed in 2 to 3 years because the reserves have run out.
So maybe the audit will speak to some of this and draw it out because nobody wants to spend money, right?
No.
And we know it on the health and homelessness front. We know it on the police services budget. We know it on so many fronts. You talk about spending money to, and I think that's part of BRT too. You talk about spending money to achieve the big vision change, and then everybody wants to pull it back to, okay, well, we can't afford that, so let's pull it back to something else. Forgetting that when you pull it back to something else, it is something else. Mm-hmm. So then you haven't got the top-notch transit system. And to say that we have a great reputation with London Transit, and ignoring earlier the feedback that that riders of paratransit have said for years, then you can't say LTC has a great reputation because they can't. They can't have a great reputation if significant riders are stuck without access to transit. So we have to fix these things, and that's going to cost money.
Yeah, and again, I've got no problem with doing the audit. Let's open up the books. Let's see what's going on. And hey, maybe if you like, and if you want to make the case to me that we'd be better off with bringing transit in house, all right. Open up the books. Let me see it. I don't know if we're going to be able to get there. We'll see. But like, make your case. Fine. And but your case better be good.
Well, it gives council more direct.
Yeah.
You know, instead of appointing councillors to a commission, it gives them more direct control. I'm not sure they're up to it.
And I'm not sure they're up to it either.
But again, why are you not hauling Jerry and David? They're on the commission board. Right. They should be able to answer the questions.
Right.
And then you decide whether or not Jerry and David keep their job on the commission. And sorry, Jerry and David.
Yeah, that's fair. And the other thing I'll say is this is when we're talking about whether we're going to, you know, look into the books and bring it in-house or whatever. How many HR and IT people are you going to be able to, how many of those jobs are you going to be able to merge into one? Yeah. I don't know how many of those LTC has. I don't think it's lots.
Nope.
And it's going to cost more to have those LTC mechanics on the City of London's union contract than it is on the current ATU 741.
And that was one thing that I had here. Like, I mean, LTC operators are making $6 to $8 per hour less than what our comparable municipalities are. Mechanics are making $4 less. And the staff, all the admin staff over at LTC aren't unionized and would then be unionized if they move over to City Hall. And again, that's just
Steve
strictly
Holland's
from
bat the, signal that you right.
That's just strictly if, you know, but what is it? I think labor accounts for, I think it's 67% of costs at LTC. So it's like, the commission negotiated
which is actually quite low in comparison to other transit
services.
Very low.
So it's like, I don't think that they're going to find the cost savings that they think they're going to find over there.
No.
Well, and that may be
true. And neither are they going to find the planning efficiencies given engineering's track record in the city.
There's that. I will say again, though, if Steve Holland were on this particular episode of the show, he'd think this was a great idea. he's the president of Keep Your Local 101, Cities Inside Workers, if you don't know. We got to wrap up because we're almost out of time. Thank you so much to Sarah and AJ and Steve for doing the show with us this week. The Craig Needles podcast, of course, is brought to you by the Covent Garden Market and our friends over at Downtown London. You can find us at classicrock981.com and londonnewstoday.ca.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.